cases, Parney, well users, and many others versus state engineer, Southern Indian Tribe, and BP America, and many others. It's case number 2012 SA 13. Argument set for an hour. Each side has a half hour. I would ask the attorneys that are handling the case to, when you speak, please tell us who you are and who you represent. I would also ask the plaintiff appellees to keep track of your time. And lastly, one other housekeeping matter, tell you that we do use iPads. Keep all the briefs on the iPads, and we link it to Westlaw and our notes and so forth. And that's what we're doing when we're using them. So let's proceed.
May it please the court, John Steyer on behalf of the state engineer. I will be arguing on behalf of the appellants for about 10 minutes, and then Mr. McElroy will argue for about 7 minutes on behalf of the Southern Ute Tribe, and then Mr. Miller will argue for BP for around 3 minutes, and then we'd hope to reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal. Your Honors, 3 years ago, the state engineer was handed a tough assignment to determine whether and in what manner to administer within Colorado's water rights system the 40,000 plus oil and gas wells across the state that may withdraw groundwater, otherwise known as produced water. Now, with help from the General Assembly, the state engineer was able to tackle this assignment. In a process involving many of the parties in this room, the state engineer adopted rules, the produced non-tributary groundwater rules, to provide for efficient administration of these 40,000 oil and gas wells. The rules assist the state engineer by determining which wells withdraw, in which geologic formations across the state withdraw tributary groundwater, and which wells withdraw non-tributary groundwater. And that determination is critical to the state's administration of groundwater because non-tributary wells cannot, as a matter of law, cause injury to tributary water rights. Now, in an appeal of the produced water rules, the Division on Water Court upheld the rules against numerous objections from the plaintiffs. But the Water Court invalidated one of the rules, the Fruitland Rule, on the basis that it applies to groundwater in a geologic formation located both inside of and outside of the Southern Ute Reservation. The Water Court held that prior to adopting the rule, the state engineer must obtain a judicial ruling as to the scope of his authority. The Water Court's holding is incorrect as a matter of law. First, the Water Court applied the wrong legal standard. Second, plaintiff's argument that the state engineer abdicated his authority to pass the Fruitland Rule is inconsistent with the rule and with the record. And third, the Water Court's ruling would force the state into tribe into litigation where none is required. So I want to start first about the Water Court's application of the wrong legal standard. Now, the legal standard the Water Court should have applied is clear. Agency rules are presumed valid. A facial challenge to a rule must be rejected unless there are no circumstances in which the rule can be found valid. Now, the Water Court did not presume the Fruitland Rule valid. Rather, the court held that in order for the Fruitland Rule to be valid, the state engineer must first demonstrate the rule's validity by obtaining a judicial ruling. However, there is no law requiring the state engineer to obtain such a ruling. In fact, courts have held to the opposite. A federal court addressing this issue specifically held that a statute facially applicable to a tribal member must be presumed valid unless demonstrated invalid in all circumstances. As the Tenth Circuit's explained, a plaintiff may not flip the burden and require an agency to prove a rule is always lawful. Rather, a plaintiff has to either through a facial challenge demonstrate the rule is never lawful, or through an as-applied challenge establish specific circumstances in which the law is invalid. The Water Court's holding flipped the burden on the state by forcing the state engineer to prove the validity of the rule rather than requiring the plaintiffs to prove that the rule was invalid. In fact, the Water Court forced the state to prove that the rule was valid even though there's no showing that the rule was invalid. Plaintiffs have argued that the state engineer has not only the authority but the obligation to administer water rights within the Southern Ute Reservation. And the Southern Ute Tribe has not challenged the Fruitland Rule. In fact, Mr. McElroy, the attorney for the Southern Ute Tribe, is sitting next to me at the appellant's table. And as Mr. McElroy will explain, the Southern Ute Tribe not only proposed the Fruitland Rule, not only supported the Fruitland Rule, but proposed the Fruitland Rule. In short, given the presumption of validity that must be afforded the Fruitland Rule, and the fact that no party has shown the rule to be invalid in any circumstance, the water court's ruling invalidating the rule was error as a matter of law.
This seems very curious to me, because I thought that Justice Lohr in the Southwestern case, with regard to non-tributary groundwater, basically recognized that the non-tributary groundwater is water of the public, subject to the plenary jurisdiction of the General Assembly.
I would agree that, yes, that is true. And the state engineer's interpretation of the law is that we have jurisdiction over non-tributary groundwater, and we must administer that groundwater. Not only can, but do have the obligation. In that sense, we agree precisely with the plaintiff. We have the authority and the
obligation. But what I'm saying is there's already a judicial determination that this type of water is water of the public.
That's
subject to the plenary jurisdiction of the General Assembly. I assume these acts, too, define who may have the rights to pump it,
I agree.
Use it, etc.
I'm sorry, did I?
Yeah, well, I mean, would you agree with that or not?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, yes. And in fact, the jurisdiction, whether the state had jurisdiction or not, that wasn't even a question before the water court. That's not a question that the water court realized it had the authority to address. And it didn't address that question. What the water court did is simply say, you haven't shown me that you have that jurisdiction, and that is the wrong standard. Now, plaintiffs don't contest this legal standard, as far as I can tell. They have not appeared to disagree that the court must presume the Fruitland Rule valid. But rather, they advance a couple of alternative arguments. They argue that one sentence within the produced groundwater rule invalidates the Fruitland Rule. And they're referring to what's known as the tribal rule. And that reads, these rules and regulations shall not be construed to establish the jurisdiction of either the state of Colorado or the Southern Ute Indian Tribe over non-tributary groundwater within the boundaries of the Southern Ute Indian Reservation. Now, they argue that by passing this rule, the state engineer gave up his authority to adopt the Fruitland Rule. But that argument simply twists the clear purpose and the plain language of the rule. And let's talk about that purpose. Now, as noted, the tribe proposed the Fruitland Rule, and there is no current controversy over the state engineer's ability to rely on that rule. But, as Mr. McElroy will explain, the tribe also proposed the tribal rule. And the purpose is simply to preserve the tribe's right to raise an as-applied challenge in case there is some controversy that arises with respect to the administration of water rights within the Southern Ute Reservation. Now, the idea is that jurisdiction within the Southern Ute Reservation is not a black and white test. It's not an easy answer in all situations. There's not just state versus tribal interests, but tribe versus federal interests. There are tribal members and non-tribal members. There are Indians and non-Indians, and there are fee lands and not fee lands. The state engineer recognizes he doesn't have the ability, given all these possible different circumstances, to, in a rulemaking hearing, resolve all questions that may be raised, and all as-applied questions that could be raised regarding these different jurisdictional situations. And even if the state engineer had that ability, he doesn't have that authority. The state engineer cannot, in a rulemaking proceeding, establish or disestablish the state's jurisdiction. So they agreed to adopt the tribal rule, not to abdicate anyone's authority, but for a simple purpose, to preserve the state's and the tribe's ability to address as-applied challenges on an as-applied basis, on a case-by-case basis, if these controversies actually arise. And again, I'd like to emphasize that at this point, there is no controversy.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
Why was it necessary to preserve that right? Is there some notion that by passing the rule, you would be stopped from challenging the rule as being inapplicable or something like that?
I think that question is best addressed to Mr. McElroy. But yes, in our discussions, they were concerned that by participating in this proceeding, they could waive jurisdictional objections in any type of situation, even one maybe involving really peculiar fact situations. And in order to preserve their ability to raise an as-applied challenge in that sort of circumstance, the tribe wanted to adopt the tribal rule.
So you see the passage of the rule as being, in effect, a concession to the tribes to assuage their fear that they would be stopped?
Yes, I see that, but I also see it as a simple statement of the law. In effect, I feel like the state engineer, you know, frankly, when this rule was passed, it seemed to me to be just simple statement of the law is the law, because we can't make that determination in our rulemaking proceeding, and it was of no concern, I should say, that it did not raise any red flags for me, because I realized that this is the law. We can't make jurisdictional determinations, and we're going to put those down the road. And
I take it then what you're saying is you were willing to make this concession because it was beneficial to somebody else's concern, but you consider that provision to have no effect whatsoever.
That's correct. And in fact, if you look at the record, that's exactly what the record reflects. The state engineer was asked specifically, or by the plaintiffs, if you pass this rule, you're giving up your jurisdiction. And we specifically responded, no, we're not giving up our jurisdiction. And in fact, the tribe said the same thing. No, this doesn't waive anyone's objection. And that's clear in the record. Now, I'd like to quickly address one other argument that the plaintiffs, well, they argue that if you look at the language of the statute, the rules and regulations shall not be construed to establish the jurisdiction of either the state or the tribe, that language is somehow the state giving up its jurisdiction or abdicating its jurisdiction. But the plain definition of establish is to bring into existence, originate, create, or found. And again, the state engineer does not have the authority to bring in existence through a rulemaking proceeding anyone's jurisdiction. So it's that statement shall not be construed to establish is simply a statement of the law. The plaintiffs also argue that the tribal rule invalidates the Fruitland rule because the state engineer intended to decline to administer groundwater within the reservation. But there's absolutely no support for this in the record either. The statement of basis purpose specifically provides that the Fruitland rule would be used for purposes of the state engineer's administration and permitting of wells. And they argue that, well, you're only delineating groundwater or determining what's tributary and not non-tributary. You're not administering water. But in administering water, the first thing you have to do is determine whether it's tributary or non-tributary. That determines what type of permits you're going to issue, what types of terms and conditions to impose on those permits, and whether the well is going to cause injury to other water rights. So, Your Honor, in conclusion, the rules have been a success. They're a pragmatic solution facilitating the efficient administration of over 40,000 oil and gas wells across the state, over 1,000 within the Southern Ute Reservation. And plaintiffs agree that the Fruitland rule is an effective administrative tool. In their answer brief, they specifically admit that using the Fruitland rule would advance the principles of ensuring certainty and avoiding injury. And given that, it remains a mystery to me why they insist on interpreting the tribal rule in a way that would get rid of the Fruitland rule. All that interpretation accomplishes is preventing the state from relying on what everyone, including the plaintiffs, admit is a really useful administrative tool. Now, under clear canons of construction, the court should interpret agency rules not to render rules invalid, but if possible, in a manner that validates rules. Accordingly, the court should interpret the tribal rule in a manner that validates the Fruitland rule. The court should interpret the tribe in a manner that assists the state engineer in fulfilling his statutory duty, and in plaintiff's own word, advances the principles of ensuring certainty and avoiding injury to other vested water rights.
Before you step away from the podium, if I could just ask a follow-up question. Your argument seems to be that the court applied the wrong legal standard, but is it really more that the water court misinterpreted or misunderstood what the tribal rule accomplishes?
I think that certainly is part of it. But, you know, it is interesting because the court admits that the tribal rule doesn't abdicate jurisdiction. And he says that, and in that sense, he says that the tribal rule only seems to be the state admitting that it could not make this determination. So his ruling is a little bit confusing on that issue. If he is somehow saying that the state was abdicating his authority, then yes, he misinterpreted the provision. But I'm not sure that is what he's saying because he also says I can't make jurisdictional determinations. So there's a little bit of uncertainty there. But the bottom line is, I think the way he interpreted it was simply the state seems to be thinking they can't make that determination, and that is correct. But then he says because they can't make that determination, the rule must be presumed invalid, and that is the wrong legal standard.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I'd like to turn this over to Scott McCoy. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Scott McElroy for the Southern Ute Indian Tribe. I want to touch first on the tribal rule. The tribe itself, of course, was a supporter of these rulemaking proceedings. The tribe holds both senior federal water rights and junior state water rights. It's very interested in the rulemaking proceeding. The tribe is also highly dependent on coal bed methane development on its reservation to support its tribal government. So it's very interested in maintaining the orderly development of coal bed methane. The tribal rule, as Mr. Siren pointed out, is intended to do two very limited things. It was not meant to inhibit the state engineer's exercise of his authority as he sees it under 137.7 for the administration of non-tributary water used for mineral production. It was meant to say simply two things. One, that this case, that the rulemaking should not expand into a determination of the respective jurisdiction of the tribe and the state over non-tributary groundwater on the reservation. And secondly, to clarify that while the tribe was participating in the rulemaking proceeding, it was not acquiescing in anything beyond the rulemaking proceeding itself. So it was not conceding state jurisdiction in all instances over non-tributary groundwater on the reservation.
Can you explain to us a little bit, because you practice in this field and know the kind of lay of the land west-wide. Why this sensitivity about state versus tribal sovereignties and relationships?
Well, tribal jurisdiction and tribal self-government is an incredibly important concept to tribes. It's well recognized in the federal law. There is, in fact, a settlement of tribal water rights for the Southern Ute Reservation. The state and the tribe do not interpret that settlement precisely the same as it applies to non-tributary groundwater. And so our effort here was to protect whatever arguments we might have while facilitating the rulemaking proceeding to go forward. And there is no outstanding challenge now to the state's exercise of its authority under 137.7 on the reservation.
And in fact, the tribe doesn't have any objections to the state engineer issuing well permits for non-tributary wells.
There's been no objection to the issuance of the permits. There have, in fact, been permits issued to the tribe. What we've tried to do is simply to preserve our argument in the event there is a dispute in the future over what we may believe is overreaching in some respects with regards to non-tributary water. But for the non-tributary water on the reservation, the state has proceeded with its obligations under 137.7, and there is no objection, formal complaint to that activity by the state.
Now, would it be fair to say that in this general arena, what is going on is a consultation process between states and tribes and the federal government? That's government to government.
Yes, the Southern Ute Tribe and the state of Colorado have a very good working relationship. And if you think about the issues that exist in a general context, which is part of the problem with Judge Hartman's notion that we have to determine all jurisdictional issues finally before we can proceed, before the state can proceed with any regulation that geographically would apply on the reservation, that's just not a workable concept. As Mr. Siren said, jurisdiction is very difficult. It involves weighing tribal interests, federal interests, state interests. You have to identify those interests, you have to weigh them. And so the tribe and the state, as the state engineer sent out in his brief and as we set out in our brief, have a long history of consulting, working out the differences, preserving their respective positions in the event that there is an ultimate dispute over some particular activity, but coming up with a day-to-day working process. And that's exactly what we believe was accomplished here. That's what the Fruitland Rule does. I agree with Mr. Siren on the appropriate test for judging it as a facial matter, that it has not been shown, could not be shown to be invalid in all circumstances. And the tribal rule, quite simply, was never intended to detract from the state engineer's use of the Fruitland Rule in his administrative activities, and it hasn't done so. So we think the Fruitland Rule can live nicely with the tribal rule. There is a preservation of positions, but there's no reason to strike down the Fruitland Rule, that it accomplishes what all parties wanted to accomplish at this stage. Unless there are any more questions, I would turn the podium over to Mr. Miller.
Good afternoon, Zach Miller, Davis Graham and Stubbs on behalf of BP America Production Company. BP and the other CDM operators very strongly support the positions and arguments of the state and the tribe, and I'm not going to repeat any of those this afternoon. And in the interest of time, because we're a little bit behind schedule, I'm just going to address one particular key issue in this case that I think BP and other CDM operators have a unique and useful perspective on, and that is the key point raised by plaintiff appellees on appeal, and appeal only, that somehow this rule is invalid because it was not adopted to assist with the administration of Section 3790-137-7, because they allege that the state has abrogated its right to administer these wells within the reservation, and in fact has declined to administer these wells and CBM non-tributary produced water generally. In point of fact, not only has the state made extremely clear in the record and the pleadings that it does not abrogate that authority and that it does intend, in fact, to administer as well as delineate this non-tributary groundwater, but more importantly, as a matter of practice in the real world, the state, in fact, already has and is administering this non-tributary groundwater and CBM wells within the reservation all throughout the San Juan Basin. And to give you several examples of that, as Mr. Simon briefly alluded to, CBM operators have obtained hundreds of water well permits from the state engineer for non-tributary and tributary CBM wells, both outside and within the reservation, without exception. And for all of those permitted wells, operators are required to operate the wells and record their withdrawals and monitor and report to the state in the same fashion as for wells outside the reservation. CBM operators have also obtained multiple substitute water supply plans for tributary and non-tributary wells within and outside the reservation, non-tributary wells until their non-tributary status can be conclusively confirmed, hopefully in this case. And finally, CBM operators have over a dozen water court cases pending in Division 7 that the state engineer is integrally involved in to ensure that these CBM wells, both within and outside the reservation for both tributary and non-tributary groundwater, are properly adjudicated and, where appropriate, have adequate augmentation plans. So in short, the state engineer, there's no real debate about whether it's going to administer these wells and non-tributary groundwater within the reservation. They're already doing it. They've expressed a clear intention to continue doing that. The tribe has not objected to that. And for the first time since the regulatory morass created in the wake of the Vance case, both the CBM industry as well as all...
You meant regulatory opportunity, correct?
Opportunity, that's the word that came to mind. That's exactly right. But the state and the legislature and the tribe, cooperating with the state, have met that opportunity and finally provided some certainty.
In advance, all we were supposed to do, and we did, was to look at the tributary groundwater, correct?
That's what we all thought.
And then the legislature decided to be more comprehensive and...
I think it was in part a reaction to the plaintiffs and some other parties alleged that the advanced case in fact stood for the proposition that all tributary wells, oil and gas wells, had to be permitted, and a number of other issues that the legislature then addressed to provide some confirmation on those points. That's all I have. Unless you have any further questions, we'd like to reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Sarah Klon on behalf of Appley's Bill and Beth Vance, Jim and Terry Fitzgerald, San Juan Citizens Alliance, and the Oil and Gas Accountability Project. I'm joined at council table by Alan Curtis. This case involves the Water Court's interpretation of the tribal rule, Rule 17.3F, to find that the state engineer failed to assert jurisdiction to regulate the groundwater beneath the reservation. And we believe the court properly concluded that without jurisdiction to regulate the groundwater beneath the reservation, the state engineer had no statutory authority to promulgate the Fruitland Rule in the first place. And we respectfully request that the Water Court's order be affirmed.
I've got a threshold issue on this, and that is how the state engineer, under any conceivable viewpoint, didn't have the duty to implement what the legislature provided with respect to delineating, mapping, however you will, the non-tributary versus the tributary water.
In the
aftermath of the Vance case.
Sure. Justice Hobbs, the General Assembly's statutory grant of authority for the state engineer is found in Section 3790.137.7 Part B and it provides that the state engineer may adopt rules to find groundwater to be non-tributary to assist with the administration of subsection 7. The tribal rule, by its plain language, establishes that the state engineer isn't sure whether he has jurisdiction to regulate the groundwater beneath the reservation. It's not appropriate under those circumstances to give the tribe an exception under state law to the prior appropriation doctrine, because in the absence of these non-tributary rules, the CBM wells on the reservation would presumptively be tributary. And there's no dispute that the state engineer has authority to regulate tributary groundwater on the reservation. So the state engineer has, in perhaps a more neighborly manner than was necessary, fashion, waded into a jurisdictional area with the tribe and agreed to language for the tribal rule that can only be read to create a question about his ability to regulate that groundwater. Mr. Siren referred to you to the fact that the tribe's interest was in retaining the ability to make an as-applied challenge when the state engineer takes an administrative action that they don't agree with. And they've been very clear, I think, in their briefs. I don't think they've tried to hide the ball, that they have, in the words of one of the briefs filed below, a sharp disagreement with the state engineer about the scope of the authority of the state engineer for non-tributary groundwater on the reservation. Leaving aside for the minute the illogic of that the tribe would want to take advantage of a state law concept, non-tributariness, which the General Assembly has decided is it to be an exception to the prior appropriation doctrine, and not also want the burden of administration. It doesn't strike me as something that survives very long when this is finally looked at by folks that can make that decision. However, under the circumstances we're in now, the cleanest route is the route the Water Court took, which was to read the tribal rule, assume it to be valid, which it did, and to find that the language of the tribal rule, by its terms, invalidates the ability of the state engineer to adopt the Fruitland Rule. And this business about the state engineer having already started administration, it's true. He started the paperwork related to administration. He's drawn the maps, as you say, Justice Hobbs. He's issued permits. He's collecting information from the CBM operators, which incidentally, most of the CBM wells on the reservation are operated by industry. So industry is, through the tribe, gaining a benefit here. And this stuff has started. But what happens to water users in La Plata County when they want to go in and tell the state engineer, this permit you issued over here with these terms and conditions, well, BP's violating them, and we want you to red tag the well. And the state engineer investigates, and he discovers that, in fact, there is a violation of the terms and conditions of the permit. That's when administration matters.
We don't have a case like that now, and it would seem that this whole onion of sovereignty, vis-a-vis the state and the federal government, all the historical and legal development on that, the only real party that can raise this issue of the tribal jurisdiction is the tribe. And we've just heard basically that they've acceded to this whole rulemaking.
Well, they just
with the reservation for a particular circumstance where they might want to take over the administration in a certain situation. This has arisen, I think, as you well know, throughout the West. And generally in settlements, these kinds of issues have been avoided so that these jurisdictional matters don't have to be decided in a vacuum. So this is not an advisory opinion, I would suggest. Contrary to what Chief Judge Hartman says, Water Judge Hartman says, this is not an advisory opinion here. This was the state engineer implementing the plain intent of the General Assembly, and the only entity that has the standing to raise the sovereignty of the tribe doesn't object. So how do your clerks even get into this ballgame?
We're in the ballgame because the reason we brought Vance in the first place was to create some certainty around regulation of coal bed methane wells. And we find ourselves in this uncertain situation where we're just waiting for the tribe to drop the hammer, where there's the possibility that the, and I realize, I agree with you, this there is not a dispute on the table right now, but I don't think it's a ripeness problem to the extent that's where your question is going. The case in, cited to you by the tribe and the state ward v. New York stands for the proposition that ripeness should not defeat this kind of an inquiry by the court. In other words, in that case, the people challenging the statute were not required to break the law before they had the opportunity to raise the legal issues. And it's the same thing here. Water users, vested water rights in Colorado, should have the protection of the law without having to wait until, you know, 3 years from now, the tribe decides, okay, well, we're not going to stand for this anymore. We're going to file suit in federal court. And meanwhile, nothing has happened that will assist with protection of vested water rights.
But, Council, if I could interrupt you right there. If, in fact, you're saying that jurisdiction would have to be hammered out before any well permits could actually issue, doesn't that lead to the same delay?
I don't think that the I think the starting point here is that you don't need to have a non-tributary determination on the reservation in order to have certain regulation of the wells. So the well permits.
How explain that to me, please. Okay. I'm a loss.
So the state engineer has jurisdiction that's undisputed to administer tributary groundwater on the reservation. If, imagine for a moment, in 2009, instead of coming to the rulemaking and proposing the what I would consider to be mutually inconsistent tribal rule and Fruitland rule, the tribe had just stayed home. There had been no Fruitland rule promulgated. The water on the reservation would be presumptively tributary. The tribe's water court applications that Mr. McElroy mentioned to you would be proceeding in Division 7 water court to obtain augmentation plans. There would not be any jurisdictional question about how this was going to move forward. Instead, what we have is a situation where the state engineer is, it's almost like the tribe is giving the state engineer jurisdiction.
They seem to be consenting.
Sorry?
They seem to be consenting.
Correct. They do. They consent to the permits. They consent to giving well logs. At what point do they stop consenting? And for my purposes, what are the impacts to vested water rights? I think this is a situation where it is important for that jurisdictional question of how the tribe could ever be the sovereign in charge of a state law concept of non-tributary water ought to be hammered out ahead of time. And I think in that respect, it's distinguishable from the Ward v. New York situation. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Could I follow up on that, bringing it back to what I understood Mr. Siren to be saying, just even more fundamental kind of than what you're asking. I took it he was saying this rule may have some benefit for the tribes, but we can't decide our own jurisdiction. We can't grant ourselves jurisdiction, so it has no meaning with regard to us. Are you saying that they can determine their own jurisdiction rather than the statute deciding that?
That the state engineer can determine his own jurisdiction?
Yeah.
I think the state engineer takes the jurisdiction granted to him by the General Assembly. And if the tribal rule said the tribe's position here is that this does not establish the state or the tribe's jurisdiction over non-tributary groundwater in the matter, that would be different. But the plain language of the tribal rule seems to me actually disavows the state engineer's jurisdiction. When the language says that it does not establish the state engineer's jurisdiction.
Do you think the state engineer could do that?
I do. I think agencies can decline to do things, and I think that's what has happened here. Yes. And I think it has a legal consequence. It's not just a matter of declining to do it. It has a legal consequence. So.
If rather than a rule, if just in a brief to the court or something else, the engineer had opined that his jurisdiction didn't extend so far, mm-hmm. would that limit his jurisdiction in some way? Or do you see the rule as really being important as some kind of positive law that limits what the legislature granted them?
The rule is the state engineer's own statement about what the state engineer believes the extent of his authority is. And in that respect, it's different from a legal argument in a brief, which might accrue to the detriment of the state engineer in future legal actions. But presumably in a brief, the state engineer can take those kinds of positions. But I think the language of the rule, I mean, we're in a nation of laws. And we got to take the laws and the regulations as we find them.
Well, we had a real case when we decided to advance the state engineer. I mean, and Justice Coates' point is that we determined what the jurisdiction was, regardless of what the Oil and Gas Commission, what the state engineer were saying. We looked at the law and applied it. Mm-hmm. That case came about in the way we like to handle cases, real facts, real controversy. You know, we knew what we were dealing with. You're asking us, it seems to me, for an advisory opinion, forcing entities to take sovereign positions with each other that they've decided to avoid. I don't think that you're reading this language correctly, and I think that Chief Judge Hartman didn't either. It seems to me just a standstill agreement while the game's being played.
Mm-hmm. Well, we believe that the water judge, I think we disagree, Justice Hobbs.
Well, let's hear why it interferes with what you clearly established in the Vance case. You know?
It interferes with what we established. What we established in the Vance case was that coal bed methane groundwater diversions are a beneficial use under Colorado law.
Tributary groundwater.
No, that they're a beneficial use under Colorado law, with the addition, I guess, that all groundwater is presumed tributary until demonstrated to be otherwise. You have to overlay that with the language of 137 Part 7, which says you only need a well permit for oil and gas produced water if the use is beneficial. And from that, what happened was the state engineer said back in 2009, whoops, I've got 40,000 oil and gas wells out there. If the presumption of tributariness is going to apply to all of those wells, then I need to get some authority from the General Assembly so that I can make rules to determine some of that water to be non-tributary. And as the briefs have told you, the rules were promulgated. There have been rules promulgated for two-thirds of the state. They've been upheld as facially valid with the exception of the Fruitland rule. The state engineer took the actions that he felt were appropriate under Vance in order to limit his administrative burden in the rulemaking. And honestly, my clients were, in fact, involved in that rulemaking. We thought it was a good idea, too. However, we were not signing up for the situation in La Plata County, which is the largest CBM well field in the state, where the tribe gets the benefit of the non-tributary determination, which, as we know, is a benefit. It's a benefit to water users. You don't have to get an augmentation plan. You're not subject to priority administration. But they're also trying to avoid the burden of administration. And they're playing, if I can, with all due respect to my esteemed opposing counsel, a little bit of a game. Well, we're going to consent to this until we don't want to consent to it anymore. And that is not the way that we've done things in Colorado as far as protecting vested water rights. I think it puts water rights at risk. I think it puts my client's water rights at risk, because at least the Fitzgeralds border the reservation, they have serious concerns about the way some of the wells EP is operating on the reservation are being operated. And I guess, you know, that's the reason we're here.
Can I just ask you a sort of a basic question? So your concern is that after a while they might not consent, and that would have an impact on you. But why, if they chose not to consent, wouldn't that in fact make this case ripe? And we would determine then whether there was an impact on you.
It's true that would make it ripe in the purest constitutional sense of the word, Justice Rice. I will agree with you there. That's right. In the meantime,
can I just ask a follow-up question? Sure. And given that, I guess all of us are concerned about really what it is you're asking us to do, and whether in fact you're asking us to give you a bit of an advisory opinion at this point, absent what we like to think of as ripeness facts, some sort of real dispute, something we can get our hands around.
I don't see it.
And what are we supposed to say? What, maybe another way to come at it is, what is it you want this opinion to say? What's our holding?
Your holding is that the state engineer is without authority to adopt rules for non-tributary produced water unless the state engineer can assert jurisdiction over the groundwater to be regulated. And the tribal rule, adopting the interpretation of the water court, undoes the jurisdiction.
All right, that's clear. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Could I come back around to my question just a little?
Sure.
Assuming you're right, for purposes of this argument, and that the engineer really could decline jurisdiction or limit his jurisdiction in some way by rule, do you think the language of the rule in this case can fairly be construed to mean that? I think his argument was, and relying on the language, that all it says is the rule doesn't establish jurisdiction, but it doesn't say anything about limiting jurisdiction that the legislature has granted. Would you care to address the construction problem?
Well, I don't view it as a construction problem. I think the water court properly viewed it as a statement of the state engineer's position about his uncertainty about his ability to regulate under the law. And it does bring into question this whole jurisdictional dispute, which we know from the briefs is very real. The preferable route perhaps would have been for him to say to the tribe, very nice, glad you have a dispute with this, I'm going to adopt the rule, period, end of discussion. We wouldn't be here, Justice Coates, if the Fruitland rule had been adopted in the absence of the tribal rule, because at that point, I don't think we would see the tribe here. What's the tribe going to do, appeal a non-tributary determination on the reservation? I don't think so. So there's we're in a sort of a legal rock and hard place situation here. If we don't argue that the water court got it right, then a couple of years down the road, we run the risk of having things come back and bite us, and that's the situation, I think. So, yes. Other questions? I can try and go back to my outline. I think we have really surrounded all of the issues that I had in my outline anyway, and rather than belabor these points, I'm going to just conclude and say that we would ask that this court affirm the decision of the water court invalidating the Fruitland rule. And
let me ask you this: Why do we only have a piece of this case? Is there no challenge to the rulemaking in general anywhere else? Is this it, or is there something else coming at us?
There, on the case Judge Hartman had, Justice Hobbs, there was a general challenge by a variety of plaintiffs, many of whom are not here today, challenging the validity of the rules as a whole. The water court affirmed the state engineer's rules with the exception of the Fruitland rule. What is still pending in Division 1 and Division 7 are arbitrary and capricious challenges to the individual basin rules. So those are on hold until this is resolved. So as far as the overall judicial review, this is the only piece of the overall rules that this court is going to see. Thank you.
May it please the court, John Siren on behalf of the state engineer. I'm just going to take a couple minutes and then turn it over to Mr. McElroy. First, I would like to talk to the statutory interpretation issue. I believe that if you look at the language, it's clear that the state engineer is not giving up his jurisdiction. In order to interpret it as being an abdication of jurisdiction, you have to sort of torture that plain language. And I guess if we can't make the determination from the plain language, I guess I would like to look at the record, where in the record there was this contention that we had given up our jurisdiction. And in response to that, this staff of the state engineer replied, "I would say no, we have definitely not given up jurisdiction." So the rulemaking record makes clear what the intent of the party was, intent of the agency was. And if there is a question with respect to interpreting an agency rule, then the solution is, well, to look at the rulemaking record, but also to give deference to the interpretation of the agency adopting the rule, to give great deference to that agency. And here, our interpretation is quite clear. It's completely consistent with the language. In case there is some doubt about what the language means, the record is really clear, and our position is really clear. And it seems to me not to make sense to take a tortured interpretation for the very simple, for the sole purpose of trying to invalidate another rule. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the plaintiff's concern that down the road there could be something that drops, and there's a situation where the state may not have jurisdictional authority or something. Well, then that gets us back to the whole facial challenge issue. This is a facial challenge to the rule. There is not a specific application that's being challenged. And in that sort of circumstance, you can only have the rule declared invalid if the rule in its entirety is invalid. You can't have a rule declared invalid based on the fear that down the road there might be an interpretation of it where it doesn't apply. And in fact, the courts have specifically said that as well. The fact that a regulation has the potential to be applied unlawfully in specific circumstances does not mean that the regulation is facially invalid because it is without statutory authority. That would be exactly the case we have here. We have a fear on one party that maybe it'll be applied unlawfully, but until you can actually point out that specific circumstance,
But it's clearly not very good rulemaking if there is that kind of a possibility. I mean, I think that's basically the argument, is that, you know, what Judge Hartman is trying to do is to get some of these things settled before he approves these rules.
Well, Your Honor, it would be nice to be able to make that settlement, but that's, in some cases with state and tribe regulations, it's quite difficult. We have a very complex situation. And frankly, you know, the hope on our party's side is that there never will be another case, that we have resolved this issue. But we can't simply foresee all possible objections that will be raised. And with that, I guess the last point I'll make is that they're concerned about uncertainty. Well, striking the Fruitland rule would give us the most uncertainty, because we would no longer have a rule that would guide how we administer wells within the Southern Ute Reservation.
Sure, you now, Ms. Klein answered that. You treat them as if they were tributary and require augmentation plans.
Well, Your Honor, and that would be unwise, I think, administration as well, because water users have the right, the statutory right, to have their waterway declared non-tributary. By taking that tact, we would effectively be denying them that right. And supposedly, even if, and I guess with that, I should, if there's no further questions, I'd like to leave some time for Mr. McElroy. Thank you.
I do want to echo what Mr. Siren had to say, that reading the tribal rule, reading it in the context of what happened, that it cannot be read to divest the state engineer of authority to implement his duties under 137.7 as he sees them. right within 17.3A, the beginning of the same portion of the rules that includes the tribal rule, is the clear statement that the Fruitman, that the rules produced are going, including the Fruitman rule, are going to be used to assist in administration. That's what's happened here. Is there some uncertainty over the tribal issues? Yes, there is. But we thought, and I think it's true, that if you read the tribal rule correctly, you allow the state engineer to use the Fruitman rule to move forward with his administration, you get the most certainty. If we delay and try to structure, as I think has been addressed here, the theoretical possibilities that could exist with regards to non-tributary water, we will have uncertainty for a decade at least if we're forced to adjudicate those sorts of questions. And the last point I have to make is there is already an admission of this uncertainty. When the Vance case was in the trial court, they stipulated out of the case the question of what was the state engineer's jurisdiction over tribal mineral interests. There are two exhibits that relate to that that were attached to our proposed rule before the state engineer. And so there is already uncertainty. It was uncertainty that the Vance parties recognized themselves. And so here I think what we have done is move forward an orderly process. The tribal rule was never intended to get in the way of that rule, that orderly process, and we would ask, therefore, that you overturn the decision by Judge Hartman to void the Fruitman rule and have it reinstated and put back into place. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all the parties for your arguments and your numerous briefs.